Good morning, I'm Mark Gunnery, producer for The Mark Steiner Show. On Friday, Mark participated in the Split This Rock Poetry Festival in Washington, D.C. with Mark Nowak and Bill Ayers. They reflected on the politics of writing and George Orwell's 1946 essay, Why I Write. We're excited to bring you this conversation from Split This Rock, where educators, students, and writers from across the country wrestled with the political objectives of writing in a contemporary world. Here's that conversation.
I'm Mark Nowak. I'm the director of the MFA program at Manhattanville College in New York. I think this is my third, maybe, Split This Rock Poetry Festival. I love coming every time. Really, I put this panel together to just really hang out with the people on my left and my right. On this side is Bill Ayers. People probably know who he is. You may not know about his newest book, which is Public Enemy, Confessions of an American Dissident. And on this side, Peabody Award-winning journalist, radio host Mark Steiner from The Mark Steiner Show on 88.9 FM. Welcome. Thank you very much.
Mark has done a lot of work with workers, domestic workers, workers across the country and world in creative writing and writing their poetry, which we're going to play with and examine and talk about the kind of writing Bill has done and other people do. And we're going to read one of the poems that one of the workers wrote in Spanish and English and then talk a bit about that. I'm just going to start by reading how he opens this. And George Orwell wrote this, and he found his political soul after he began writing when he was in the Spanish Civil War. And that's what exploded the fervor of both the belief in democracy and socialism in him and his necessitated him to take on discrimination, oppression, totalitarianism in his work. So we'll start off with this. These are George Orwell's words. It is simply a question of which side one takes and what approach one follows. And the more one is conscious of one's political bias, the more chance one has of acting politically without sacrificing one's aesthetic and intellectual integrity. My starting point is always a feeling of partisanship, a sense of injustice. How does that fit?
I love that Orwell piece, Why I Write, and I've used it a lot with my own students, and I urge them after they read it to try to articulate why they write. But you jumped right to the political, Mark. And what I love is he says there are four reasons.
I haven't gotten there, but okay. You can take a second.
Well, there are four reasons why all writers, right, including myself, he says,
right, exactly,
put words to the page. And one he calls sheer egoism. And then he says, I can't deny it. I want to be looked at and listened to, and isn't it exciting? And second, he calls aesthetic enthusiasm, liking the way words sound and kind of reading them over and over. The third, he calls historical impulse, the desire to set things straight. But then that fourth is political purpose,
right,
and that's where you leapt in. And I think, and he basically says about himself, I would have been perfectly happy with the first three if it had not been the Spanish Civil War, which just turned me, and I have written less beautifully but more exactly. And I think there's something kind of compelling about that. It's not the only way to think about why we write, but it's an interesting starting point from one of the great ethical observers of the horrors of the 20th century.
So, I mean, what it does, I think, I'm glad you raised those other three things, because the question I think he's raising here, and we'll see how we all think about that and how you all think about this, is that a lot of political writing can be polemical and really boring. I mean, I don't want to read half of it. There's something about my dear anarchist friends. They write for days and days and days, and I go to sleep as I'm reading it. So you,
we used to say about the great weatherman statement that was written when,
right,
Students for Democratic Society was being undone, and we used to say a close reading of the weatherman statement will drive you blind.
Right,
and you
can, exactly.
And you can tell that it was written by a committee because it is absolute dreck. You know,
I
still agree with the politics, but I found reading it just impossible.
So that's where the aesthetic comes in. And that's how you marry the idea of what you feel politically inside with the aesthetic beauty of the words and the imagery and how you write.
Yeah, you know, I think one of the things I've been doing for the past decade or so are these poetry workshops with different labor organizations, worker centers, and worker groups. And so, you know, I've done them in Chicago, in closing Ford plants in Minnesota and South Africa with domestic workers. And for the past 3 years, doing them for the Penn World Voices Festival, the organization Penn in New York City does this great festival every year where they bring about 30 or 40 writers writers from around the world to do different events, readings, et cetera. And so they approached me a few years ago to do one of these workshops, which I did with a great group in the city, Domestic Workers United, who had passed actually the first domestic worker bill of rights in the country in New York State that Governor Patterson signed a few years back. And then with last year with taxi drivers in the city, and most recently with migrant farm workers in the city. But it's this sense, you know, I even talked to the labor organizations that they fall into this sort of dreck of language that, you know, you'll get these documents from them that will be so quantitative with so many pie charts and so many, you know, tables and statistics, but it won't have the stories of the actual people who are part of the struggle. So one of the reasons for my doing this and working with organizations, I was having a conversation once with the International Trade Union Confederation about trying to expand this domestic worker poetry writing workshops more globally. And what they said is they really like the idea because the poems and stories of the workers can become pressure devices that they can use with different legislative bodies, because there's a difference to say like 80% of workers in London who are on temporary visas will, et cetera, et cetera. But when you have a little YouTube video clip of someone saying like what's going to happen to them when they return to Indonesia after 6 months and their visa expires, makes a very different impact than that statistic does. And I think they're both necessary is the key point.
Yeah, you know, you make me think. I mean, Mark's work is absolutely extraordinary with workers' groups. But Pete Kahn is in the room, and he's one of the originating teachers of the Louder Than a Bomb, the poetry festival for young Chicago authors. And there again, you find, you know, you get a bunch of teenagers writing. And on the one hand, you want to say, this is great. It's the unheard voices. It's coming from the bottom. And it is great. And there's something in that impulse alone that's great. On the other hand, some of it is quite cliched, quite formulaic, quite, you know, and I often think the opposite of aesthetic is anesthetic. Anesthetics put you to sleep. Aesthetics wake you up.
Right.
And if you go to Mark's work or Pete's work or a lot of your work, what you find is a huge amount of waking up, but also a fair amount of cliché-driven, you know, kind of nonsense. And mm-hmm. So it's not an automatic fit, right?
I was thinking about when you mentioned YouTube, mm-hmm. and I was thinking the whole time you all were talking that it's beyond the written word. We're talking about the year 2014 and not 1946. This is where I'm curious how you think the aesthetic and the political will and word come together, because we're in a world now where a lot of what people get comes from these machines, these phones and our iPads and whatever things we have, and that people look at things in a very different way. It's a new aesthetic of telling a very political story, of telling a story of struggle, of people's lives, that kind of grabs and moves people. I was on a panel the other night at Red Emmets in Baltimore that I ran, and my old friend Paul Coates, who used to be one of the leaders of the Panthers, was on the panel. And he said, I'm not a community organizer anymore. He said, I am driven by passion. It's the passion of my love for black people that drives me, and I'm driven by passion. So, I mean, so you know what I'm saying? So we're in a place now, I think, that's a bit different than the polemical past, at least I hope.
Maybe. I mean, I think, you know, when you say it's new, I immediately think, you know, tweeting is the new haiku. Is it new or is it old? You say it very quickly, get over it, you know, and so on. I mean, so I don't know. I'd be a little reluctant to be nostalgic for any past that didn't exist, any past whatsoever. But I do think that these ways of communicating have, you know, important possibilities in them, I guess. And I think that people are exploring all kinds of ways of using them to communicate their deepest feelings. But the thing that you hit me with when you say driven by passion, your friend, driven by passion, besides Orwell, the other place I look sometimes is to Edward Said's brilliant piece, Representations of the Intellectual, in which he talks about what should drive the intellectual. He says the landscape is more cluttered with intellectuals than it's ever been, consultants and advisors and this and that. But what should drive an intellectual is this notion of passion and amateurishness, not the professional, but rather a sense of staking out an independent view and fighting orthodoxy and dogma. And that is possible in a lot of different forms.
there was a time in this workshop I did at Ford plants in South Africa in 2006 where I sat down and, you know, I had done them at various places before, and they're usually like a 90-minute kind of creative writing workshop. And when I sent this letter off to NUMSA, the union that organizes the South African auto workers, I had been used to, like, you know, you send this off to a union and maybe you never hear from them again, and, or American unions, they're like, oh, thank you, but we're not interested at this time, et cetera, et cetera. So I send this email off to South Africa. I wait like 2 days. Then 2 days later, an email comes back. It's 2 pages long. And they say, we would like you to come. We'd like you to come to both Ford plants in South Africa, one in Port Elizabeth, one in Pretoria. We'd like you there for 2 8-hour days of poetry workshop at each plant. Are you a vegetarian for your catered meter meal? And here's the cell number of the driver who will pick you up at your hotel. And so it was... Because, though, this idea of, like, a political literature being so prevalent, you know, for so many years in South Africa, that this was not an anomaly, that we bring these categories of Orwell, like the political and the historical and the ego and the aesthetic, that we bring them together inside of an auto plant, for example. Like, that was not we've done this before. Let's do it again. This sounds like a great idea. And let's get workers in two places talking, because the managers at Ford Corporation, they are constantly having meetings, flying to India, flying to China, talking and conversing. But the workers have never seen each other, have never talked to each other, don't even know what a Ford worker in another country might look like. And so that through this process, we can sort of begin these conversations was a really great thing. But in that workshop, I remember really clearly the first morning I came in, there were 17 people for the poetry workshop, and one worker leans forward and he says, what is poetry going to do for me when I become redundant? Mm-hmm. Right? What is poetry going to do for me when I become redundant?
Wow.
And to me, I feel like I've spent the last decade trying to answer that question.
How do,
like,
people answer it? Was it answered?
It wasn't answered in the moment. It opened up, I think, a conversation for what it can do. But the one thing I would say is, going through that 16-hour poetry workshop with them, at the end of it, he said he noticed one person and the strength of his language. And he said, you know, that person who is on our committee, our union executive committee, I think we should name him, he didn't use this language exactly, but like poet laureate of our union. Mm. And his words moved me so much that I think every time we open one of our union meetings, he, Philemon, should open with a poem about what we've been discussing, what we have to talk about, so that before we get into the sort of everyday, that our spirits become moved first. Right, and that's one of the actions that I think poetry can accomplish.
That's right? I mean, I think that's absolutely beautiful, and it brings me back again to the teen poetry work, because, you know, it's a recognition that this kid who has been labeled in school as a loser or BD or LD or all the other alphabet soup we use in urban schools suddenly is seen as a three-dimensional human being by the people around him or her, by the teacher perhaps, but most importantly, by himself or herself. What an extraordinary thing. And so I think those kinds of workshops that you all do have that potential. And I think they also have the potential to, what's it going to do for me when I'm outsourced or laid off? I mean, I think it also gives us a space to imagine alternatives. I mean, that's what the imagination does. It gives us a space to be moral people and to think that the world we have is not the only world that's possible. And learning that is key to living a full life.
So, I mean, I think this is a critical moment, I think. This is a critical thing you all are saying, to me anyway, that we're in a space where there is a lot of creative energy and work being done by students, by workers, by folks who are not associated with a university or associated with a poetry center or a film center, and are just doing the work. And it's driven by that, what you were just talking about, it's driven by that passion that pushes it out. And it's also very political, as a lot of hip-hop stuff is talking about what people's lives are like and what people are living through. And we sometimes forget, I think, because it's often about books that are published and authors who have names, that a lot of it is being surged and pushed from below, that is being seen by communities and not seen by the larger world, and connecting those things. That's what's happening right now. I've been doing some programs recently on, it made me think what you were saying, it kind of connected, maybe it won't, we will, we'll see, but on Afrofuturism, this new kind of genre of art that is kind of exploding underground across America and Africa, and where it takes the past and the present and the future are all interlaced and interwoven, and paintings and books and articles and films and sculptures are being created. And I wonder how we think this all fits into maybe a future aesthetic about where we're going as a culture as a whole. I'll just describe this one painting and see what you all think. There was this painting by Decarneau, who's a painter out of L.A., and it started with images of the 1967 rebellion in Detroit, and then he painted a wave coming over those images, an ocean wave coming over those images, and under the wave was this undersea world that had been founded by people from the Middle Passage who had gone overboard and went to the depths of the ocean to create this world.
Wow.
And showing the interaction between past, present, and future, what could be, what might be, and what happened. So I'm saying? Mm-hmm. In some way, this whole movement is, I think, going to begin to redefine how we think about political art and writing and where it takes us. Just your thoughts.
I mean, that sounds astonishing and wonderful. But what I was thinking as you were talking, Mark, was, you know, I draw on a couple of things when I think about the power of poetry and the power of the work in Chicago, for example. I often think of Emily Dickinson saying, you know, imagination lights the slow fuse of possibility. Without an imagination, you're stuck. And with an imagination, you can see that standing next to the world as such is a world that could be or should be. And that creates disturbances. It makes you long for things. It makes you wonder. It makes you challenge. That's important. But there's something else I felt like I wanted to interpose, and that is that I think when people like us get together and talk about the imagination, we can get very soft and cuddly and want to have a group hug. But we have to remember that imagination goes in all directions, and that Auschwitz was an incredible act of imagination. It's an act of imagination that's terrible, destructive, murderous, and heinous, but it is an imagination that many of us couldn't have accessed on our worst day. So I think that we have to be thoughtful about the fact that the imagination, when I think of the power of imagination, I want to think, as Maxine Green often says, of the social imagination, the imagination of a better world, a society more inclusive, more joyful, more just, and so on.
When you were talking about that, I mean, I agree absolutely, and I always think of this word aspirational, right? And that, like, imagination toward what, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, and so I always go back often to this book by Jacques Rancière called Proletarian Knights.
Yeah.
I don't know if people know the book, but he looks at, during the French Revolution, all of the, like, worker journals and letters and poems, in particular, why it was interest of me. But he doesn't say this exactly. In fact, he says, and he doesn't quite say this, but one of the central messages is that the worker who writes poetry is more dangerous than the worker who maybe protests or sings protest songs, etc. But he says this because the poem helps the worker to imagine himself outside the locked box of being the worker, right? And so I have something else that I can become besides what I am. And so that notion for what literature can do, that it can take us outside of one framework to believe, I mean, getting back to your question about Afrofuturism, that there is this history, there is the present, but that there is a future. And how can what we do address that sort of trajectory, as Bill said, in a particular direction.
Yeah.
It's not just here's imagination, but what do we want that imagination to accomplish?
And sometimes, I mean, imagination is anarchistic, and sometimes we can't predict, and we shouldn't predict. We should open ourselves. I was thinking as you were, I have a lighter example of your same point, which is Yi-Yun Lee, who is a novelist some of you know, and her latest book is Kinder Than Solitude. But she won a MacArthur Genius Grant and was interviewed. And she said, my parents didn't want me to read. I mean, she became an MD, I think, before she became a writer. And she said, my parents didn't want me to read novels, and they certainly didn't want me to write. They thought it was, you know, an unrespectable kind of profession. And she said, the quote that I loved was she said, they didn't want me to read books because they thought it would put wrong ideas in my head. Exactly. And that's exactly what it does. It puts wrong ideas in your head. That's why we should encourage it.
Let me take a detour and read this poem that you brought with you.
Okay.
All right. This is one of the, will you set this poem up?
Sure. So for this year's Penn Festival, I've been working, I live in upstate on the Hudson River, and I've been working with a great organization that's headquartered in Kingston, but also has offices in Albany and Rochester, called the Worker Justice Center. It's a great legal center that's doing incredible work with migrant and immigrant farm workers, dairy workers, et cetera. So we're meeting once a month at the Worker Justice Center with a number of workers doing a poetry workshop, and we'll do an event on May 3rd, Saturday, May 3rd at the Penn Festival. But we've just been reading a wide range of Latin American and Caribbean poets, and this poem was, we were reading a lot of Neruda. And so this was one of the workers from the upper or mid, I guess, Hudson River Valley, after having read Neruda. This is the poem he wrote in our workshop.
So I'll read this Spanish and then English. And we can just kind of wrestle with what this might mean and what poetry means for all of this and for change. Okay, this is the poem's entitled Así es mi nombre, por Ranulfo, which is his name. La rana canta y toca su guitarra al río de un río. El agua vuela tan ágil como un papel en la aire. La noche no solamente se duerma, también se trabaja. El universo es in lejos. Como ningún otro lugar. La luna mira como un búho con un solo ojo. La fe es como el hielo. Se congela por rato y se derrite en ocasiones. El ostión bebe su café con popote. This is how my name is. The frog sings and plays his guitar at the river shore. The eagle flies as nimbly as paper in the air. The night does not only sleep, it also works. The universe is so far like no other place. The moon looks like an owl with only one eye. Faith is like ice. It freezes for a moment and melts on occasions. The clam drinks his coffee with a straw. That was a beautiful piece.
It is, you know, and there are these moments just in these workshops, and they happen all the time, you know, where just this past Sunday, for example, there was a person who hadn't come to a few of the workshops. And, you know, you always start doubting what you're doing and thinking that this isn't meaning that much to people and why write poetry, so on and so forth. And so he came back. His name's Antonio. He came back to workshop this Sunday, and we worked on this. We were doing this set of paired haikus on spring and the transition from winter to spring, invierno y primavera. And so we worked on those for a while. And at the end of the workshop, he said, I was away. I was back home in Mexico visiting my family. And I wrote a poem, and I'm not ready to workshop yet. I still have to work on it a little. And he pulled it out, and here's page one of the poem. Here's page two of the poem. Here's page three of the poem. And I'm like, oh, Antonio. So I can't wait till workshop in a couple of weeks to see what this poem is about. All he would tell me is that it's a love poem.
Beautiful.
Thinking about this and poetry and where poetry is now and how poetry has become almost a physical force in terms of how it's presented in the world today. You know, it was very polite and people read it and had a cup of tea. I mean, now poetry is literally a physical force. Maybe it always has been, but I mean, you can feel it. Let's marry these ideas, the aesthetic and change. What role does poetry play? I mean, think about, he was inspired by Pablo Neruda. Neruda's work as a revolutionary in Chile and others, Amir Baraka, and in this country, many others we could mention a name. And what role that plays in this world that we want to change?
Well, one of the things that I find consistently when working with these organizations is that they're really interested in this project. I'm not presenting something that's, why should workers write poetry? In fact, they see they're engaged in a series of campaigns, be it the domestic workers, be it the migrant workers now, certain legal cases that they're arguing in New York State Court, et cetera, where that the idea that we can, in newspapers, in their website, in YouTube videos, and elsewhere, provide these really personal stories of what are happening to individuals becomes incredibly powerful. So I think that here we have like the aesthetic and the political in a way married, because we still want – I mean, I think that poem that you read is just such a beautiful piece, but at the same time you hear these rumblings of work in the evening and so on and so forth that come through in them. And so the organizations are very interested because this gives them another way to kind of support the arguments that they're trying to make in terms of political action.
A couple of things come to mind. One is I'm always drawn to Mary Oliver's little segment in the middle of one of her poems called Instructions for Living a Life. She says in three lines, she says, pay attention, be astonished, tell about it. And I think, wow, that's good instructions for being a moral person, for being an activist, for being an artist. Pay attention. Be astonished at both the beauty and the joy and the ecstasy out there, and also the misery that we visit upon one another, the unnecessary pain. And then do something, write about it or say something about it. And when you began, Mark, you were talking about a painting. We weren't talking about poetry. So let's mush it together. As you were talking, I was thinking about, for example, the recent passing of Nelson Mandela and the whole narrative that was constructed around Mandela as a grandfatherly guy who would put us all in his lap. When he passed away and that narrative became a little too sticky, it wasn't untrue, but it was just a little too overbearing. The fight back coming from many, many intellectuals, writers, artists was wonderful. And suddenly the New Yorker appears, and on the cover is not Grandfather Mandela, but Mandela coming out of the Rivonia courthouse as a young man, defending everything he'd done. And wow, that was an artist entering that dialogue and saying, no,
right,
we're not going to frame it one way. We're going to have this discussion and we're going to fight about it. And I think that's an intervention that poetry does. It's an intervention that art does. And we need our imaginations intact in order to participate in that.
Should we participate all together? Let me.
Hi, I'm Kit Bonson. I'm on the board of Split This Rock. And I wanted to tell you about an interesting story that was reminded to me because of the union stories that you guys are telling. I also am on the board of a national pro-choice organization, the Abortion Care Network, which is made up of independent providers. Because of the two organizations that I work with, I thought it would be great to have a collaboration. So we had a pro-choice abortion rights poetry contest for the last 3 years. And when we first did it, I think that a lot of the people who come to this meeting, which is mostly a professional meeting for independent providers, were kind of like, oh, poetry, I don't know about that. But when they heard these poems, they felt so validated by what they had experienced that they were just blown away. I mean, at a conference, normally, you know, there's a lot of stuff going on in the background while people are talking. The room became quiet, and everybody really engaged with it. And in fact, one of the readers this year told me she hadn't even read the poem before she agreed to do it. And on the plane, she was so blown away by the poem that she decided right there and then that she wanted to put them up on the walls of her clinic and hand them out to everybody who came. So that's the power of poetry and the interaction between the professional and the cultural.
I like that a lot. Go ahead.
Bill mentioned Louder Than a Bomb, and Mark was talking about, you know, what will poetry do for me when I'm redundant? And a couple of my friends coach Team Inglewood. And Inglewood, if you don't know, is a part of Chicago that's in the news a lot for the violence. And they've done amazing work at this school. And they did a group piece on the school closings. Apparently, they got 55,000 hits on YouTube in the next few days. And then the mayor's office invite them in to have a meeting about the school closings, which they're very conflicted about, right? They can't stand the mayor, but maybe this is something that could lead to that. So that was pretty amazing in terms of what kind of initial power it can have. And I'd love to hear from John Sands and Adam Faulkner about the work you guys do with young people in poetry.
A lot of the work that I do is I've taught high school for 8 years in New York City. And I am very curious about using art as a vehicle into discourse across lines of difference and identity and conflict. Curious to hear the two of you and anybody else talk a little bit more about the potential for art, specifically creative writing, but I think art more generally than that, to enable a kind of imagination and discourse, of course, that is hugely political, that few other forms can. I know that's leading and it's loaded, but I think sometimes when we're able to talk about a painting on a wall or talk about a poem that we've experienced, much more willing to enter a conversation about the violence that's happening in Inglewood after wrestling with the work that these young poets bring to this space than I am if somebody walks in and says, let's talk about the violence in Inglewood.
Absolutely.
So I'm curious about your
What high school?
I taught at the Academy for Young Writers.
Okay.
In Brooklyn.
I found in my own teaching that things that are very, very difficult to talk about in a kind of sit down, let's have a meeting way, especially with kids, but with each other as well. Let's have a meeting and talk about race and let's see if we can get to the bottom of it once and for all. Well, it doesn't really go that far. You introduce, I remember in one of my classes, introducing the Colored Museum. We went and saw a play called The Colored Museum. Holy cow. It just exploded. It was a group of students, about half black, half white. But we couldn't get past, you know, the kind of didactics of it until we interacted with a piece of art. And then, ba-boom. Similarly, I felt like much of my adult life, I was a student of the Holocaust. I knew a lot about the Holocaust. And then along comes Spiegelman with Maus. And I felt like, holy cow, there's a dimension that I never understood, never considered. It's a new way of thinking. And Mark's daughter and my granddaughter and me have been going back and forth about a wonderful new comic book called Boxers and Saints. I don't know if you know it, but it's the story of the Boxer Rebellion. And you may think you know about the Boxer Rebellion. Read this comic book, this piece of art that introduces you into something in a dramatically new way. One of my granddaughters, who's 9 years old, kept coming to me as she was reading and saying, "This is really confusing. This is a good person, but she just did a terrible thing." Exactly. You know, that's puts wrong ideas in your head and so on. But I think it's a reminder of what the great Chicago poet Gwendolyn Brooks said in the beginning of her poem, Dedication to Picasso. The opening line is, "Does man love art?" And her response, "Man visits art but cringes. Art hurts. Art urges voyages." And it's those voyages as teachers that we so are looking for. And in the Louder Than a Bomb work, in Mark's work, you can see these voyages again and again. And it gives you great hope, you know, for what we could become.
You know, in January, I was down in Florida to have some meetings with a group that to me was maybe the most inspirational workers group I've ever worked with, the Coalition of Immokalee Workers. And what they're doing in Immokalee, Florida, if you don't know about it, just go to their website and look at them. But they've literally, you know, gotten places like most of the fast food restaurants beside Wendy's to sign these agreements so that the tomato pickers can make more money. But they have a cultural center, a radio station, a food store, offices. They're organizing. They just did a huge bus tour up to Columbus, Ohio, so they could have a huge protest at Wendy's corporate headquarters. And when I went down there and we were talking about what we could do with poetry in terms of the Immokalee workers, the workers brought up the idea that they wanted to try in poetry to tell the history of the organization. So next spring, what we're going to do is we want to try to create a new history of the organization. And this could, if I were a muralist, we could do this through murals, and they have it there. If I was a musician, we could do it through a series of songs. I'm a poet, and they're incredibly interested. I'm now trying to talk with some letterpress printers in Florida so that we can do a nice big broadside of this, that the workers can write, like, what the history of their organization is, was, and will be, to get back to Mark's Afrofuturism comment. And so it's like, it's incredibly powerful because you see this energy from individuals that someone else doesn't have to come in and write the history of our organization. We don't have to have a academic book, as much as I love them, on that. Or let's have them all, in fact. Let's have the mural and the academic book and the poem and all of that, because it's so important to have those multiple interpretations of history, and poetry is one way to tell that story.
And the dance and the comic book, you know, still on your point and your question, I'm thinking of Maxine Green, who was one of my teachers many years ago in New York. The Jacob Lawrence Migration Series paintings was at a museum in New York, and we took groups of kids from high schools to see the Jacob Lawrence Migration Series, the great series about the migration of black people from the South to the North in around the 30s and the 40s. And then the challenge was for each kid to either, through dance or poetry or story or visually, to depict their migration story. And one of the wonderful things is we all have a migration story, every one of us. Where did you come from? How did you get here? Where are you going? Those are radical questions to ask a group of high school kids, and to provoke it with Jacob Lawrence was a stroke of genius.
It made me think of another Orwell quote, how this all fits together. One of my favorite new quotes that I've been thinking about a lot is that Orwell said that they who control the past control the future. They who control the present control the past. And he was talking about the totalitarian right. worlds. But what I keep thinking about is our world. Are doing that ourselves is what you all are talking about. What we're talking about is we're controlling it
right.
and making that happen no matter what they control.
One last project that comes to mind around this provocation about high school also comes from Pete Kahn's high school experience, which is Avi Lessing, who's a brilliant English teacher at Oak Park River Forest High School. I was out there, and Pete and I were there together, watching a performance in the style of Anna Deavere Smith. He had his students go out into the community and interview their parents, their classmates. The most touching one in many ways was the custodian. And the interview was supposed to be around the question of home. And then they performed bits of this oral history in series, one after the other. And it brought the house down. I mean, it was a brilliant, brilliant interaction, which was about history, controlling the present, looking to the future. And to have all these kids participate in an aesthetic experience that was an oral history experience, that was a literary experience, was nothing short of brilliant.
I taught at the University of Wisconsin-Whitewater for several years, and every year we did a creative writing festival for high school students, and we always got contributions from the young Chicago writers. And aesthetics was never a problem with those contributions. Right. It's the politics that was the problem. Well, it was experiential, which is fine, and general, right, quote, social criticism in quotes, but it was never analytical. Like they never could get past, right. And then apropos of the Boxer Rebellion comic, that's only one of several really good comics and graphic novels from a radical point of view. And graphic novels offer a grand opportunity for young people to get into political writing because it's very aesthetic, to say the least.
I've had that same experience, be part of that festival, and just to show you how writing disturbs people, the worst disturbance we ever had came from the Chicago writers, where one gal wrote a story, a lesbian story, and in her workshop, one of the others, you know, straight kind of person, took it to parents or took it to teachers, and we had fights for I don't know how long after that, you know. Are we going to continue this festival? That was one of the best things that ever happened there.
Yeah, I think that's a great example. And thinking again about Art Spiegelman, look at some of the covers he's done for The New Yorker that have absolutely created pandemonium in New York. You know, the Valentine's Day cover where the Hasidic rabbi is kissing the Caribbean woman. Holy cow. The city came apart at the seams, you know. And or the Guns of September, where you have a group of kids getting on a little yellow school bus with their AK-47s. I mean, this is a comment that really needs to be heard. And the fact that it causes pushback and pandemonium is exactly the point. And I think that's your point.
I have a quick question for the panel. My name is Deontay Osiande. I'm a poet and teacher from Detroit, Michigan. And we're kind of getting hit on from like all fronts, from, you know, violence to homelessness to, you know, lack of jobs. And one question that I have is I work a lot teaching the youth. And that's one way that with the whole gentrification process that's going on, that's one way we're keeping the youth involved. But there's a lot of adults who aren't able to get jobs, and jobs are given to people from the surrounding suburbs that are now moving in. There are a lot of retired elders that are losing their homes and losing their pensions because of everything that's going on with the political process of them trying to redevelop the city. And my question is, I know how to get poetry to help lift the youth to do something, but how do we get those parents and those grandparents, those pensioners, and those unemployed adults?
Look,
how do we get them involved?
All the older people in the front row and me are all cheering for you, you see? Gerontology, yes. There's a writer named Hal Adams who passed away not so long ago, a Chicago writer, but he developed a journal called the Journal of Ordinary Thought. And it was a journal that came out of the writing of people in public housing, homeless people in homeless shelters, and so on. But the last thing he did at the end of his life, when he was living in Minnesota and living in an old person's home, he started a writing group in the old person's home. And they, too, published a thing, and a journal of, it was called Real Conditions. And the real conditions of their lives became the stuff that people, and Hal always contended with Paulo Freire and John Dewey and a lot of others, that it's naming the world. Naming the word is part of naming the world. Moving yourself to act in some ways requires a naming. And so the things you're doing with young people, us old folks have to do with old people, and you can help too. But you should also get a chance to talk to Pete, don't they? Okay?
Yep. I have actually a comment on that too. I'm in conversations now. I have a friend who is a lawyer for the Puerto Rican Teachers Union. And there is a case coming up in which they think they're going to lose, in which the Puerto Rican government is drastically going to cut pension benefits for retiring teachers in Puerto Rico. People literally won't be able to survive on their new pensions. And so what we've been talking about is trying to devise a poetry workshop, and I give you this idea as a gift because I think it would work great as well, in which you bring together people who have retired and people who may lose these benefits or have lost their jobs, and you have them each write poems about, A, what the retirement benefits have meant to them, like, because I have this pension from the Chevy plant or whatever, I'm able to do these things and this is my story, and because I don't have this pension, these are my fears and these are my worries, and get them together in a kind of synergy between the two groups so that they can say, well, you know, why does one group get this and the other doesn't? Why were certain people able to retire and we don't have this possibility? I think there's a tremendous amount of energy available there between those two groups, because they are these spaces in which, for almost, you know, random political reasons, one group is able to maintain a certain way of living, a certain pension, and others aren't able to. And that needs to be so deeply explored.
What's so brilliant about this, Mark, and I'm suddenly getting excited. I got to get, because I'm a pensioner myself, you know, and I'm a big believer in it. And we all know that Social Security raised a hell of a lot of people out of poverty, and we're going right back into elder poverty as a major kind of event. But one of the things about Hal Adams workshops, and it's very similar to what you were just describing, is you get a group of people together and they begin to write, you know, what did you do on Sunday, or what happened, or what did you do on the way to school today? And somebody writes, I went by this abandoned house two doors down from the school, and it always frightens me. And she reads her little piece. That abandoned house always frightens me. There's not much to it, right? But it leads to a discussion in which everyone begins to tell stories about the abandoned buildings. And in telling those stories, they decided, this particular writing group, that they should research what's happening with abandoned buildings in the city. And they went down to housing court. They figured it out. They built a little project. It took a year and a half to get this particular house torn down. But in the course of it, they made what was experienced as private and personal, public and shared. And that's all the difference in the world. Suddenly, we're sharing a problem. I'm experiencing it as my own personal hell. But it turns out everybody else has the same problem. Once you identify it as social, there's social things you can do. The end of that story is they developed themselves into what they called the South Lawndale Thinking Tank. I thought that was a great name, you know. So now they're a thinking tank, and they're taking on issue after issue that seem personal but are actually social.
This also goes a whole way to realizing that whether you're our age or your age and all in between, that the cross-generational power has to kind of be found, and not to be afraid of each other in hearing each other and hearing each other's works. And it's there. I mean, it's happening in Baltimore now with the fight against gentrification, right where you were speaking at Red Emma's. They want to move the people out. Now there's things being built between workers and people who live in those high-rises and the young radicals in the community and the artists. And that's coming together to hear these voices. When you do it in the creative way, it's explosive. So go to Detroit and pull the generations together. Let them do their poetry together, and it'll blow everybody's mind.
My name is Joyce Latham. I'm from the University of Wisconsin in Milwaukee, originally from Baltimore, though that's my roots. I'm a professor of library and information science. We have a lot of issues, and my specialty is public libraries. And I want to point out that public libraries are a great venue for anchoring a lot of the activities that you're talking about here today. And adult outreach in particular is something that public libraries are really interested in. I talk about public libraries. I'm passionate about public libraries. I think they're a great avenue of access, and I think they are a great protection of our rights of intellectual freedom. And before you say, oh, public libraries, let me remind you that John Ashcroft, when we raised a ruckus about the USA Patriot Act,
that's right,
referred to us as those hysterical librarians.
Exactly.
All right? So don't write us off. I mean, those buns are hiding a few things.
You know, I love it. Could I just second that? I want to say two things about that. One is, if you don't know, I mean, just seconding what she said, go online, go to the American Library Association, look at their line on censorship. It will blow your mind if you think of librarians in some kind of stereotype 1950s way. They are the most militant, fundamentalist First Amendment people you'll ever meet. And in my own experience, when I was targeted and pilloried and blacklisted in a million ways, the only people who never canceled me were independent bookstores and libraries. Universities canceled my speeches, all kind of things happened, but never a library, and that's because they're so militant with those buns. God bless them.
Amen to that.
Hi, so I'm a teacher, and I started in New York, too, about 20 years ago, and I teach now at DCPS, and I'm stepping out because I can't play the numbers game. I'm a science teacher, and I write. And it's just become lots of pressure, right? It's all about math scores and reading scores. And I have a lot to say, a lot to write, but I don't want to burn bridges. It's a career I've been in for 20 years. So the political writing is real. The retirement, I don't know if it'll happen. I don't care because I can do stuff. But I want to address the question of, like, how far do you go with political writing in a profession where there's a lot to be said? And then what? Where does a profession go? And maybe I should think about changing and stepping out.
Changing?
Profession. Because it's public education, and I started in New York, I went to LA, and now I'm here, and I've taught abroad, and it's a small world, and like, what do you say? And then that's it.
Good question.
It's a great question, and the thing is that it's, like Mark's great question earlier, it has no answer. I mean, it's a discussion, and it's an ongoing discussion. It's a discussion to have with parents, it's a discussion to have with colleagues and comrades, it's a discussion that will never end. You make me think of two things. One is, you may have read that in Chicago, a couple of weeks ago, the teachers at Drummond Elementary School voted 100% to not give the Illinois standardized test. Now, if you've ever been in a school, have you ever heard of teachers voting 100% for anything? Never. It never happens. 100% of the teachers at Drummond, and I remember describing it to friends, it's a kind of I am Spartacus moment, because you just stepped out there and put your neck right on the chopping block. So maybe they'll come and chop it off. Damn, two other schools within a week said, we're not going to give it either. And then the system issued a lot of threats. And then several thousand parents, including my kids, said, we're not going to let our kids come to school the day of the test. Suddenly, they were dealing with the I am Spartacus on the open field, because enough people had stood up. That's not an answer to your question. That's just the nature of the kind of struggle that we get into. You don't know who your allies are until you say something, but you don't want to get fired and chopped up and so on. So we often censor ourselves. And in some ways, what we need is a group of friends, a group of comrades, a group of folks who think somewhat similarly. In Chicago, again, this marvelous group that's currently leading the Chicago Teachers Union, how did they find each other? They found each other by being folks who went out every time a school was closed. There were a dozen teachers out there picketing with the parents. They found each other that way. And then they began meeting as a study group. And as a study group, they began pushing each other. And then they said, why don't we run for leadership of the union? Unthinkable. They didn't think they'd win, but they did win. And, and so now they're not out there alone getting chopped up. They're actually leading a formidable, very exciting, progressive union, which was unthinkable 5 years ago.
I'm just going to toss out one other thing. My wife, who's in the row behind you, runs something called the Ed Factory, which is this collective of teachers. And she's doing this great work with Minneapolis public school teachers. And I've seen it over the past several years just grow from, this small organization that was doing things to now bringing, Patricia Smith, for example, who was here, I think, last festival as one of the keynotes, Ta-Nehisi Coates, all these educators are coming out, are having these conversations. conversations or doing these workshops that they never did before. So on Bill's point, that the things can start at this kind of small grassroots level, but if they're done collectively and together and people bring their voices together, I think this is a great example of what can happen.
And I was just thinking, as you were talking as well, that I spent many years as a teacher too before I did this radio, and political writing and all that is always a risk. You know, whenever you stand up to speak out, you have a risk of losing what you have that's under you. That always happens, which is why collectives like this were important in having the bodies of people around that Bill was talking about are kind of critical, you know, to keep that alive. But that risk is there. And I would say humbly that if the teaching is not getting in your way creatively, then don't leave it, because teaching has a power and gives you a power in your own creative work to respond to the kids and the neighbors and the other fellow writers and parents, and just push on with it, you know. Let your voice be heard, and whatever your medium is, put it out there.
Another thought on that is that we started this conversation, and Mark, you raised the question of dogmatic, formulaic, cliched thinking. And one of the things you can push yourself to do as a writer, and should push yourself to do, is to be in argument with yourself. Don't be so certain that you know anything. You know, I write personal essay mostly, and I'm really not a writer. I'm a teacher who scribbles. But I think that what I try to do is I try to write in a way that is an argument with myself, so that I'm not being didactic and preachy, but rather being wondering about things.
Can I ask you a question about that? Could you talk a little, because, you know, you had this great book to teach, and then you rewrote the book to teach as a graphic novel. So that, true. I mean, that itself was a bit of an argument. Can you just talk about that process a little
bit? Yeah, I mean, we were talking about comic books a minute ago, but I had written this book to teach, which was popular in teacher education classes, and I did a second edition, and then the publisher wanted to do a third edition, and I was so bored I wanted to jump off a bridge at the idea of it. So I said, okay, I'll do it if you let me make it a graphic, and I thought that would be the end of the conversation. And 2 months later, this academic press came back and said, okay. So then I thought, I have to find a cartoonist, and I found this wonderful young man who had been a student of my brother's and did all of his papers in cartoons, and he had just graduated art school. So we began to collaborate. For 3 months, I thought he was going to illustrate the book I'd already written, and it took me at least 3 months to understand that we were going to have to write a whole new book, because a graphic is not an illustrated book. It's its own thing. As Ryan and I used to always, Ryan Alexander Tanner is the cartoonist, and we would always have this argument. He'd say, you know, I would say something about, this is a great genre. And he said, it's not a genre, it's a medium. And all cartoon people feel that way. It's a medium, like film is a medium. It's not a genre, you know. And when we finally finished this book, and it really was a book that needed to have a narrative arc, it needed to have characters. The same ideas about teaching are represented, but they're represented as a struggle, as an idea. And then we went on book tour, and we were at my favorite moment was at the Carnegie Foundation, where they had bought books for the entire staff of the Carnegie Foundation, and Ryan and I did a presentation. And the first question was, I just love this. It's going to get young people who have, you know, attention deficit disorder into teaching. And Ryan, the steam came out of his ears, and she said, do you think this will get people interested in the real book? And Ryan, 26 years old, said, Ryan said, this is a real book. And he says, you know, he says, it's like saying, do you think if people watch the movie The Godfather, that'll get them interested in Mario Puzo's novel? He said, it's not that kind of party. The Godfather as a film has to be judged in its own right. So I think that's, you know, I learned a lot working with Ryan. I'm a slow learner, but I learned a lot. And I think that notion that there's a lot of ways to struggle with these ideas, and you don't want to get into the position where you're so sure you're right that you're putting stuff out, you know, as kind of manifestos, right?
So let's take one more thought here.
Hello, my name is Anthony Harrell. I am on Oxon Hill High School Slam Team. And as a high school student, we're in the poetry portion of our curriculum in high school now. And we've recently hosted our own open mic. And I would like to know how you can get high school students more involved in poetry and how we can make a change for what I would like to call this poetic movement which is going around my school. Because we have this little saying, we say hashtag bars, everyone has a social network. And we have people in my classes just going around saying it. And I really appreciate that everyone is starting to find themselves in poetry. But how can we build on this to where we can make it a larger, get a greater spectrum in my county, in PG County?
I mean, there are a couple of teachers here.
Bunch of teachers here answering this question.
I'll just say quickly that in Louder Than a Bomb, what's so impressive in Chicago is that this thing began 12 years ago with the Chicago Young Chicago Authors. They began offering workshops. Now this thing is so sophisticated. They have all day Saturday. There are workshops, introductions to poetry, open mic, this and this. And it goes all over the city. And it's very exciting. But in a school like Orr High School, which used to be known just for its basketball team, their poetry team is as popular in the high school as the basketball team because they've created a culture where poetry is legitimized, poetry is a way of being, and it's as demanding and exciting and inviting and engaging as anything else that's going on in the high school. That takes time, but folks like you are exactly the folks to do it. You were part of that slam team. You're part of representing what poetry can do for you and for the world. And I think that that's a huge contribution. You're doing it right now.
You want a thought? And teachers want to respond? Anybody else want to respond?
I would also add that one of the really powerful things I think I'm hearing here and having affirmed is that we don't know who our allies are in the work we want to do until we step out there, right? And that you have already built, I think a lot of times when young writers ask, what's the first step? You know, unequivocally, for me, it's always find somebody to share your work with. If that's a two-person community, no doubt, right? That's better than none. And then it's a three-person community. But if you've already got an open mic and there are people coming together and you've built this sort of electric body of something that people are expecting and they want a part of, don't be afraid to, like, ask people within your school community, outside of the school community, make flyers, put this on people's radar, use social media, right? I think that we're afraid people will dismiss us as doing something that is sort of something that's been done or is an old trick. And I would say don't count out those allies, you know, because we might not know that they're necessarily there, right? If a student asked that question in a school where I've worked, I would be elated and I would offer every single network that I have in all of New York City to help build that, you know? And I think that it's hard to even know that I would exist or a couple colleagues of mine within that specific school would exist until somebody like you would say, hey, you know, I have this idea. Don't leave me alone out here.
Closing thought, then we'll go to Mark for a closing thought.
One thing I just wanted to add in on your question real quick is one philosophy I kind of believe in when it comes to teaching is we live in one world and our students live in another. So you have to translate the information across languages. So like inform your teachers and administrators and all that, because nobody knows you're interested in this until you let us know that we're interested in this. And then at that point, we can bridge that gap.
And Mark, this is your shop, so why don't you close it out?
I just want to say, I mean, because I know that we're here at Split This Rock, and so in a certain way, we're already speaking to the converted, right? I mean, you're here at this incredible conference for a reason. In my creative writing program, I put together a course that the students have to take, and it's really on teaching them how to teach creative writing workshops in the community. And one of the requirements is they have to go out and do this. We read Bill's book, we read Frary, we read a bunch of critical pedagogy, we read, you know, June Jordan's Poetry for the People and other works like that. But the sentiment, I think, is that don't assume that organizations that aren't poetry organizations aren't interested. Because they are interested. And if you put together a proposal, I've had students, my graduate students are working in prisons, in churches, in homeless shelters, in shelters for women of domestic who've been subjected to domestic violence, to libraries. A shout out to our librarian. I have a student who's a public librarian, did a great program for kids in her library. That these organizations are really interested. And I think that for too long, the phrase I always come back to is that we've been taught too often, I think, that poetry is a noun. It's an object that we produce, that we send out and submit to magazines, that we publish in chapbooks. These are all object-based things. But in fact, poetry is a verb. It's an action. I poetry, you poetry, we poetry. And it's how communities come together. It's one of the vehicles that we can use. So don't be afraid. Think that poetry is a verb. verb, collaborate, communicate, dialogue with organizations that you think might have no opportunity whatsoever to that would be interested in poetry, because more often than not, you'll be surprised, you'll be overjoyed, you'll have a phenomenal experience, and you'll make change in the world.
Thank you all for coming.
That was Mark Steiner, Bill Ayers, and Mark Nowak on Friday at the Split This Rock Poetry Festival in Washington, D.C. Send us your feedback on what you just heard to steinershow@gmail.com. Don't go away. Coming up next, it's a special archive edition of Soundbites where we talk to farmers in Prince George's County about their philosophies on farming, agriculture, and the environment. You don't want to miss this.
The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by the Maryland State Education Association. From school funding to Common Core, you can learn about the important issues affecting Maryland students, parents, and schools by visiting the Maryland State Education Association's website at MarylandEducators.org. That's one word, MarylandEducators.org. Or you can go to SteinerShow.org and click on the Maryland State Education Association's banner.